Hello, everybody. I am John Allen, and this is Last Week in the Church. Okay, folks, after 2.5 years of conversation, speculation, and consternation, the moment is finally here. Today, the curtain rises on Pope Francis's keenly anticipated Synod of Bishops on Synodality. And in keeping with a metaphysical law of the universe when it comes to this papacy, which is, everything Francis does has to be accompanied by controversy. We've got controversy. So let's get into it. We begin with, do ya dooby ya? So, once again, a small group of conservative cardinals has submitted a set of dubia, that is, theological doubts, to Pope Francis, in this case, about the Synod. The surprise this time is that the Pope has actually answered, giving fairly detailed and fairly clear responses on the hot-button issues of the blessing of same-sex unions and also women clergy. Now, that either renders the entire Synod superfluous, or it has saved the Synod from itself. We're going to break down those two interpretive possibilities. Second up, the murmuring Synod. So as the Synod begins, there is a climate of controversy about still somewhat ill-defined expectations of secrecy regarding its internal discussions. We'll try to explain what Pope Francis may be thinking in terms of his desire to keep at least some of what happens away from full public view. Third, j'accuse. The Pope's own Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors, his chief advisory body on the clerical sexual abuse scandals, has issued a stinging indictment of the way church leaders handle these cases. We'll explain what they said and why they are saying it now. Fourth, bowling for dollars. In the Vatican's trial of the century for various forms of financial crime, civil parties to the case seem to be competing with one another in terms of who can make the most astronomic demands for compensation. The current tab is running at around $700 million. We'll explain what's at stake here in terms of perceptions of financial reform in the Francis papacy. And then finally, we've got Laudate Deum. Today is also the release date of the Pope's new apostolic exhortation on the environment. We'll go over what to expect and what its potential consequences might be. All that and more is waiting for you on this edition of Last Week in the Church. And I promise you, this is hot stuff. I mean, this is breaking news. This is stuff you are going to want to know. So don't go anywhere. Do not click away. Do not change that dial. We will be right back. So, notoriously, intelligence and wisdom are not the same thing. It is actually possible to be incredibly smart and also incredibly foolish. Footnote, it is also possible to be a total idiot and a great fool. My life is sort of a laboratory experiment in what happens when both of those things are true. But that's not our point here today. Our point here today is that history is replete with examples of the great mischief that can result when intelligence and wisdom become decoupled. If you want a refresher course in this point, by the way, I recommend you go see the brilliant new movie Oppenheimer, which is basically a 3-hour meditation on precisely this point. However, the contrary is also true. That is, if disaster is often the result when intelligence and wisdom separate, triumph and amazement is often what happens when intelligence and wisdom come together. And this is a roundabout setup for a naked commercial plug, because I am here today to recommend a new piece of technology to you. It's a new app called Magisterium AI. And basically, it is an effort to combine intelligence, in this case, artificial intelligence, with the great spiritual and ethical wisdom of Catholic teaching. It is an app that is by now trained on more than 3,000 official church documents. It is available in 10 languages, so pretty much any tongue you would, you know, wish to get an answer in. And what you can do is you can go onto this app and ask it questions ranging from really high-end egg-headed stuff to, like, explain the doctrine of transubstantiation or what were the issues in the Arian heresy, all the way down to the kinds of banal things that real people would ask, like, what's the deal with the Pope? or, you know, the Virgin Mary? Do you guys worship her? Like, what's the thing? You know, whatever your question is, this tool will give you cogent, insightful, well-written answers. So whether you are a priest who needs talking points for a homily, or you're a CCD teacher who has that one precocious kid in class that won't stop asking you questions, and speaking as the former precocious kid in class, I know how annoying that slice of life can be. I raised it to a fine art. You know, whatever. You know, whatever your needs may be. I mean, if you're just an ordinary person with questions about the Catholic Church because, I don't know, you read a Dan Brown novel or you watched Godfather 3 or whatever it is, this tool will be extraordinarily useful to you. It is the brainchild of our friends at Longbeard. That's a digital marketing and design company. They are the IT backbone of the Crux site and also of Last Week in the Church. These people are geniuses. And beyond that, they're also salt of the earth, great people. And so whatever they touch basically turns to gold. This is the latest example of it. I highly recommend it to you. Now, I'm not going to promise that if you use it, and by the way, you should. It's at magisterium.com. That's magisterium.com. I'm not going to promise you a full refund if you're not satisfied because it's free. So you don't actually have to pay anything. What I will promise is that if you don't like it, you are free to send me a note telling me that. I will use another AI app to generate an automated response in which I have no role whatsoever. I'm actually just kidding. I would pass your response along because I guarantee you the people at Longbeard want to get this right. So again, check it out. That is Magisterium AI online at magisterium.com. By the way, if this didn't convince you, and frankly it's me, so why should it convince you? But if you want a more intelligent presentation of the argument for this, read my wife Elise's article on the Crux site. It is replete with insight and elan and verve, and it will lay out the case in very compelling fashion. Magisterium.com. Check it out. All right, everybody. Happy Wednesday to you. Happy Wednesday, October 4th in the year of our Lord, 2023. Today is, of course, the Feast of St. Francis. It is also, as we teased at the top of the show, the opening day of the Pope's Synod of Bishops on Synodality. It is also the release date for his new apostolic exhortation on the environment, Laudate Deum. So lots going on. Let's get right into it. We begin with, do ya, do ya? So back in 2016, I'm sure you will remember, a group of four conservative cardinals issued a set of dubia, that's the technical term for theological doubts or questions, submitted to the Pope in the wake of his controversial document, Amoris Laetitia, which opened a cautious door to the reception of communion by divorced and civilly remarried Catholics. Now, what made all that a subject of unending controversy is that the Pope never responded to those dubia. Instead, he allowed others to speak in his name. He appeared to endorse some of those responses, but he himself never actually piped up. Okay? So now we have a new set of dubia, in this case submitted by five conservative cardinals. The common term in both cases is that one of those cardinals was American Cardinal Raymond Burke, a hero to the traditionalist wing of the Catholic Church. And in this case, the dubia concern the Pope's Synod for Bishops. Now, some of the questions concerned the interpretation of Revelation, whether our understanding of Revelation can change. They concerned the nature and limits of synodality, and also whether, well, basically whether repentance, that is changing one's behavior, is an absolute requirement for absolution in the context of the sacrament of confession. But let's face it, in terms of public interest, the two most sort of hot button points would be the question of the blessing of same-sex unions and also women clergy. And on those two matters, here is basically what the Pope said. And by the way, let me just say, these dubia were originally submitted over the summer. The Pope gave his response over the summer. We only learned about them on Monday when the Pope's new doctrinal chief, new Cardinal Victor Emmanuel Fernandez, made them public. So on same-sex unions, what the Pope said was basically a cautious yes. Okay, he said there are some cases in which pastoral judgment may dictate that giving these blessings is fine, as long as it's not confused with the sacrament of marriage. He said there really shouldn't be any general norms or rules about this. It should be decided on a case-by-case basis. When it came to women clergy, he reaffirmed the definitive no that was given to that question by Pope John Paul II, but said it can still be the object of study, comparing it, for instance, to the validity of Anglican ordination. So you can boil it down as kind of a yellow light and a red light, basically. Now, the question that presents itself is, why, for the love of God, did he answer these questions now? First of all, he didn't answer these dubia before, so why now? But secondly, if you think about it, the whole purpose of this synod is supposed to be listening, right? The pitch here was that we're going to have this whole process on synodality in which we listen to the whole people of God before we make decisions. Well, if that's the point, why is the Pope giving his answers before he's heard what anyone has to say in the synod? I mean, look, if I were a synod participant, if I had gone through this 2.5-year exercise of getting ready for this moment, right, and I had come here with something to say on one of these questions, either blessing same-sex unions or women clergy, I would be a little ticked off right now because I would say, why did you bring me here if you're just going to make these decisions before you even hear what's on my mind, before I have a chance to put in my 2 cents? So one way of looking at this is the Pope has basically made this synod, at least on its most keenly anticipated questions, he's made the entire exercise superfluous, right? I mean, why are we bothering? He's already given us the answers. Now, there is, however, another way of looking at this, and that would be that from the very beginning, there has been concern among organizers of the synod and among the Pope's acolytes and supporters, and also, for that matter, from the Pope himself, that this synod might be hijacked, might be overtaken by debate on a couple of very controversial questions, and that would cause it to lose sight of the bigger picture. The bigger picture here is supposed to be imagining a new way of being church, right? A way of being church in which the entire people of God journey together, so it's not just top-down, but also bottom-up. And the question is, what would that look like in terms of structures and procedures and ways of doing business? And it is possible, of course, that if the whole thing had gotten bogged down on a couple of, yes, controversial, but also wearily familiar questions, I mean, these issues have been with us for a long time, that it might have gotten in the way of that deeper and broader discussion. So another way of looking at this is that Pope Francis has essentially saved the synod from itself. That is, by taking these questions off of the table, he has cleared a space in which other issues, arguably far more consequential and far more far-reaching in terms of the future of Catholicism, can see the light of day. Now, you know, that can be debated and parsed any way you want. Here's the one thing I can tell you with absolute, complete, 100% certainty. Once again, Pope Francis has thrown us a curveball. Just when we thought we knew how this was going to play out, he has scrambled the deck. And this is a reminder that whatever else you want to say about the Francis papacy, it is never dull, okay? It is never boring. And on that point, ladies and gentlemen, I would suggest there is no space for dubia at all. All right, second point, and that is the murmuring synod. So, there is a great deal of uncertainty right now about precisely what the, well, I mean, it depends on what word you want to use. Confidentiality, if you want to be polite. Secrecy, if you want to have a little bit more edge. But in any event, what the requirements for keeping a lid on things are going to be at this synod, but it seems abundantly clear that participants have gotten the message that they are not supposed to be engaging the media, they are not supposed to be revealing in public the content of the discussions they're having behind closed doors. And that has generated a great deal of blowback from a number of quarters. Number one, on the grounds that it's futile. You can't bring 400 people together for a month and expect none of them to say anything. Number two, that it's irresponsible, that the Pope has invited the entire church to participate in this discussion. They all have a stake in the outcome, and so they have a right to know what is being said allegedly in their name. And third, that it is contradictory. Pope Francis has said repeatedly that he believes in transparency. Imposing a veil of secrecy on his cornerstone event, therefore, in the eyes of some, would be at odds with those pledges. But, you know, I would suggest that maybe the way the Pope is looking at this is by way of analogy to a general congregation of his own Jesuit order, where the rule of the day is what the Jesuits call murmuratio. Literally, that means murmuring. When the Jesuits have to elect a new general superior, they are allowed to have this period where they murmur to one another. These conversations are supposed to be one-on-one. They're not supposed to be in groups to avoid the formation of political parties or power blocks. They have to be kept in the strictest confidence. But the idea is that in so doing, you create a space in which the Holy Spirit can work its magic and genuine consensus can emerge. There is, by the way, some evidence that that process works in the sense that the last three Jesuit generals, that is Hans-Peter Kolvenbach, Adolfo Nicolás, and Arturo Sosa, were elected on the first, second, and first ballots, respectively, after this period of murmuring happened. So, look, whether this is futile, childish fantasy, irresponsible, and contradictory to the Pope's own stated aims, or whether it is a healthy effort to create a space in which a miracle of the Holy Spirit can happen. Look, again, you can look at that differently, you can parse it differently, but it would seem to me that there is a good case to be made that this is going to go down in history as the murmuring synod, the one in which the Pope opted for murmuring rather than megaphones. And whether that actually works, of course, will form a lot of the drama of what we see over the course of the next month. Third up this week, we've got J'accuse! The Pope's Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors, a body created in 2014 by Pope Francis to be his chief advisory body on the response to the clerical sexual abuse scandals. It is headed, presided over by Cardinal Sean O'Malley of Boston, and it numbers about 20 members from around the world, both clergy and lay, all experts in the detection, prevention, and punishment of child sexual abuse. This group, which typically, since its inception, so for the last decade, more or less, has operated pretty much behind the scenes, kind of whispering in the Pope's ear, but trying not to engage in big, noisy, public declarations, has sort of broken its silence. The members have issued an open statement, which was released ahead of the Pope's consistory last Saturday for the creation of 21 new cardinals, and of course, ahead of the Synod of Bishops. What they had to say was basically deep disappointment over what they described as tragically harmful deficiencies in the way that church leaders respond to accusations of sexual abuse and also accusations of the cover-up of that abuse. They said that too often victims are left unheard and they are left in the dark about what's going on, both as investigations are underway and once they're over. And basically they said, it is time for you guys to clean up your act. And they said, it is important that during this Synod of Bishops, that the voices of survivors are heard and that there be serious conversation about what should happen going forward. Now, in terms of the why now, well, you know, clearly the consistory and the Synod created an occasion, but, you know, there have been plenty of other occasions where church leaders came together in Rome when the commission has not popped off like this. I think the other clear factor is the aftermath of the Father Marco Rupnik scandal that is continuing to unfold. Rupnik is a famed Slovenian artist who has decorated chapels in the Vatican and all around the world. He has been accused of the sexual, psychological, and spiritual abuse of adult women, many of them members of a community of nuns, of which he was the spiritual advisor in Slovenia. Roughly 20 women have leveled these accusations for a period of time stretching over about 30 years. Rupnik was kicked out of the Jesuits over the summer after the Jesuits said they found these accusations very credible. Actually, they said very, very credible. This is like if you remember the movie Animal House, this is like double secret probation, right? Very, very credible. But what's happened recently is the Pope's own Diocese of Rome commissioned its own investigation of a center founded by Rupnik here in Rome called the Centro Reletti, basically giving it a clean bill of health, saying there's a healthy spiritual life there, also raising questions about a process that led to Rupnik's brief excommunication in 2020, saying there were grave procedural deficiencies in that process. And basically, most people took it as a kind of thumbs up for Rupnik and for his outfit. This comes on the heel of the fact that Pope Francis had granted an audience to one of Rupnik's biggest allies and supporters, a lay Italian theologian by the name of Maria Campatelli. And collectively, it has left a lot of people with a kind of head-scratching impression. Nobody knows where Francis actually stands. His own religious order said the guy is guilty, but his own diocese has given him basically a good housekeeping seal of approval. It leaves a lot of people confused, and no doubt the Pontifical Commission is responding to that. By the way, advocacy groups for the survivors of sexual abuse are here in Rome this month as the Synod is going on. They have asked, among other things, for Pope Francis to revoke a red hat he gave to Cardinal Fernandez over his alleged mishandling of a sex abuse case in Argentina in 2019. All of this an indication that although the effort of this synod may be to put the focus on the future of the Catholic Church, survivors and victims of clerical sexual abuse and their advocates are not going to allow this synod to forget about the yesterday, and for that matter, the today of the Church when it comes to the response to the clerical sexual abuse crisis. All right, fourth up this week, we've got Bowling for Dollars. So, the Vatican's Trial of the Century, which has been going on for a couple of years, this kind of mega process against 10 defendants, including for the very first time, a cardinal of the Catholic Church, Italian Cardinal Angelo Becciu, basically the Pope's former chief of staff, for various forms of financial crime, is now in the home stretch. This month, we're going to be hearing from defense attorneys, but last week, we heard from attorneys representing the third parties to the, basically the alleged injured parties to the case. So that's the Vatican Bank, technically known as the Institute for the Works of Religion, the Secretariat of State, the Vatican's uber-powerful coordinating department that sort of oversees everybody else, and then finally the Administration for the Patrimony of the Apostolic See, or APSA, basically the Vatican Central Bank. So, the lawyer representing the Vatican Bank basically said these defendants owe us about $220 million for money the bank had given to the Pope that they claimed these defendants misappropriated and squandered. The lawyer representing the Secretary of State said they owe us $188 million, mostly for damage to the reputation of the Secretary of State. She had actually commissioned a study from a media monitoring firm that found that there were 50,000 basically negative articles about the Secretary of State in various media outlets as a result of the financial crimes, most of them related to the controversial purchase of a piece of property in London that began in 2014, then continued in 2018, finally ended up in basically, the Vatican took a huge financial bath. And she's arguing this all made the Secretary of State look bad, so these guys owe us $188 million. And then finally, the lawyer representing APSA, which took over the assets of the Secretary of State in 2020, said you owe us $286 million. You add it all up, it comes to about $695 million, close to $700 million. Nobody, by the way, actually thinks these guys have $700 million, but this is more by way of saying that's how bad that this situation is. Now, what is going to be happening over the course of the next month, the course of October, right as the Senate is going on, is that two narratives in this trial will be competing with one another. There's the prosecution narrative that Cardinal Becciu, a couple of shady Italian financiers, and some sort of reprobate officials in the Secretariat of State conspired to defraud the Vatican of all of this money. Now, the competing narrative, which we will hear from the defense lawyers this month, is that this isn't about criminality, this is incompetence. That all of these transactions were approved by the top brass in the Vatican, in some cases including the Pope himself, and what they're doing right now is trying to scapegoat a handful of individuals for their own management and administrative failures. I would note that's going to be playing out at exactly the same time the Senate is going on, might stir some conversation in the Senate about how real is financial reform in the Francis era versus how much of this is kind of theatrics. I mean, are we witnessing a genuine exercise administration of justice, or is this more a kangaroo court that's basically designed to just find a few sacrificial lambs who can take the fall for the system? You know, I don't know where the balance is going to fall in terms of how people think about this, but I will say that is what is at stake. And it's another reminder that try as this Senate of Bishops might to project a forward-looking sort of ethos in their discussions, they are not going to be able to escape the atmospherics, which is cleaning up the mistakes of the past in the eyes of many people would remain a work in progress. All right, finally this week, we've got Laudate Deum. This is the Pope's new apostolic exhortation on the environment. It is conceived as a follow-up to his 2015 encyclical, Laudato Si, which was, of course, the first ever papal encyclical entirely devoted to the care of creation, that is basically ecological themes. Now, Laudato Si was deliberately issued in 2015 ahead of the COP21 meeting, that is the Paris UN-sponsored summit on climate change, where tough new, at least theoretical, limits on greenhouse gas emissions as a strategy for combating climate change were adopted. And many people at the time credited Pope Francis with being essentially the moral and spiritual chaplain of that press for getting serious about the fight against climate change. So, obviously now, you know, we are 8 years later, and a great deal has changed, some of it positive, some of it negative. And Laudate Deum is the Pope's stab at trying to bring the argument of Laudato Si up to date. It, too, is being deliberately issued ahead of a UN-sponsored summit on climate change. This one is set for late November and early December in Dubai. And it's part of a broader press by Pope Francis and his diplomatic team to try to encourage the international community to take serious measures. The Pope has already announced that his top diplomat, Italian Cardinal Pietro Parolin, is going to be putting together an interfaith meeting in Dubai ahead of the COP summit in order to try to mobilize the resources of the world's religions to support greater ecological awareness and action on climate change. Now, of course, you know, we don't know exactly what effect this document is going to have, but clearly the Vatican is hoping for something of a repeat performance from Laudato Si. That is, just as Laudato Si was credited with having a big impact in Paris, they are hoping Laudate Deum will be credited with having a similar impact in Dubai. And, you know, we should also say, of course, that the Pope has an interest not simply in the environmental issues, but also in the region. You know, Dubai is part of the Middle East, the Persian Gulf region, and largely Islamic part of the world. Pope's outreach to Islam has been one of the cornerstones of his papacy. So this interfaith assembly that Parolene is organizing is also part of that picture as well. As ever, you know, we'll have full coverage on the Crux site in terms of how all this plays out. So bottom line, ladies and gentlemen, this is a deeply eventful day, and this is going to be a deeply eventful month. Please do keep checking the Crux site. That is cruxnow.com. Again, cruxnow.com, your one-stop shopping destination for the very best in smart, wired, and independent Catholic journalism. We will have comprehensive coverage of all of these issues. Basically, my message to you is, do not turn away. This month is going to be rock'em sock'em, a non-stop exercise in thrills, chills, and spills. You're not going to want to miss all of the action, and we'll be the place that brings it all to you. Meantime, here, we'll be back here again next week, same bat time, same bat channel, to bring you the latest and greatest in evolving Vatican and global church news. In the meantime, stay safe, stay healthy, have a fantastic and blessed week, keep reading Crux, and we will talk to you again very soon.